The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. I have a wonderful guest today, an outstanding journalist, Allison Bass. Before getting to introduce her further to you, this is the new year. I had intended last week to have an open mic, first Monday open mic, but because of the holiday, that was not something that the studio was able to carry out. So we will have an open Monday mic for folks to call in on the first Monday of all the other months of the year, as far as I know, including February. And very much enjoyed our original first Monday, and I hope that we'll just continue that. With the new year, it's incredible to think about how much the Empathic Therapy Center has grown in 1 year. The Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy Education and Living, we've gotten our New York State nonprofit, our 501c3 from the federal government. We got an advisory council of more than 50 outstanding professionals and advocates from virtually every mental health field and education, even from religion, just from across the board of people who care about giving services, human services to human beings who are struggling emotionally, struggling with life, as we all do. And our conference was a great success, and Ginger has created a newsletter now with 20, free newsletter, by the way, it's free, 2,700 subscribers, many of whom actually open it and read it. It's an e-newsletter. We've got a new website, toxicpsychiatry.org, which is a part of the larger website, empathictherapy.org. And you can go to toxicpsychiatry.org, get the latest information on the kinds of issues we discuss on this show, and a library, not just current news, but a library of scientific articles that focus on the dangers and hazards associated with biological psychiatry. So it's the 1-2 punch. The empathictherapy.org focuses on how to deliver really caring, empathic, wonderful services to people. And the other website, toxicpsychiatry.org, focuses on the hazards of what we think is the bad alternative. We're not the alternative. We're the real thing when we talk about human services. The alternative, this radical new alternative, is drugs and electroshock, biological theories. And, of course, we have our upcoming conference. It's going to be April 13th, 14th, 15th, our second conference, the first one almost filled. We had about 200 people, capacity about 220. We may fill this year. Not too early to sign up on empathictherapy.org for the second Empathic Therapy Conference. It's really inspiring, and it's really informative. Now, today we're going to be talking, in part at least, about Paxil, a big Paxil trial that Allison Bass has written about. I want to give you a little background from my own experience with Paxil. Many of you listening will have some idea about it. I first got involved with issues surrounding drug company negligence, Smith-Kline's, GlaxoSmithKline's negligence in regard to Paxil many years ago in the Lacuzon case, in which a man who appeared to be emotionally quite stable was given Paxil and within 2 days drowned himself and his two children in a bathtub. Since then, I've been an expert in multiple cases, but that first one was the one where I got to go inside GlaxoSmithKline And it was in there that I made those initial discoveries that they were hiding their suicide cases. They were doing a lot of funny shenanigans to make it look as if they were getting suicide attempts and suicide cases in their placebo group when they weren't, in order to try to balance the ones they were getting in their Paxil group. They were mislabeling suicide attempts and suicides as other things so they wouldn't be detected. They were not allowing the U.S. Investigators who work for them to even list akathisia, which is a horrible and frequent side effect of Paxil and can drive people over the edge to violence and suicide. These and many other things that I've documented in scientific articles, as well as in my two most recent books, Medication Madness and Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, the second edition. So I go way back on these Paxil issues. And so it's going to be really interesting for me today to talk with Allison Bass. Now, Allison is spelled A-L-I-S-O-N, and Bass is B-A-S-S. You can find her easily on the website, on the Internet. She's written a book called Side Effects, and the subtitle is A Prosecutor, A Whistleblower, and A Best-Selling Antidepressant on Trial. And Allison herself is an investigative journalist. She writes about medicine, science, technology. She's writes for the Boston Globe and other publications. And in this book, she tells the story of how the pharmaceutical giant, good old GlaxoSmithKline, systematically misled physicians and consumers about the safety and efficacy of Paxil, chemical name paroxetine. So I'm really happy to welcome to the show Allison Bass. Hello.
Hi, it's very good to be here.
Allison, how did you get interested in all this? And tell us, just talk about it, because I think you've got a lot to say about this.
Well, sure. Well, I first began to get a sense of how flawed the drug research business is when I was a reporter for the Boston Globe in the 90s. The story of Paxil, or my book, all started with an anonymous phone call from a woman who had left a cryptic message with the Globe City Desk, something about the misappropriation of funds from a state mental health agency. And as I was the Globe's mental health reporter at the time, the message came to me. And so it was late in the afternoon. I had just filed a daily under deadline, and I almost didn't return the call. But I picked up the phone, and a woman who identified herself as Donna Howard answered. Now, Donna explained that she was the assistant administrator of research for Brown University's Department of Psychiatry, and that she had in her possession documents proving that the chief of psychiatry at Brown was collecting hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health for research that apparently wasn't being conducted. She had other allegations to share with me as well. She said she suspected that researchers in the psychiatry department were misrepresenting data for two clinical drug trials, including one study on Paxil for treating depression in adolescents. So I met with Donna Howard. She turned over a box full of documents, and I wrote about billing and research transgressions by Marty Keller, the Brown's chief of psychiatry. But then, years later, in June 2004, I read about the New York Attorney General's lawsuit against GlaxoSmithKline for allegedly deceiving people about Paxil, and I suddenly remembered what Donna had told me about the Paxil study almost 9 years prior. Back then, I hadn't been able to pin down her allegations about the Paxil study, of which Keller was the principal investigator. But now it appeared as if the New York Attorney General's office had done some of that for me. So with a few phone calls, I discovered that the Glaxo lawsuit by the New York Attorney General's was the brainchild of Rose Feierstein, a feisty newcomer to the Attorney General's office. So now I had two amazing women in this story, and I decided that there was something here with a way to tell a story that would be a gripping narrative, but also get across the policy issues involved with what happens when a pharmaceutical company tries to deceive the American public.
Well, go on and tell more of the story, please.
Well, basically, you know, Rose Firestein was an amazing woman. She and an attorney. She had put herself through law school and spent much of her law career working on behalf of vulnerable children who were being mistreated in foster care systems around the country. And so she, while working first for Legal Aid and then the National Children's Rights Organization, she noticed that many youngsters in foster care were being overprescribed potent psychoactive drugs like Risperdal, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft. She felt that these drugs were being used as chemical straitjackets to control troubled children. And she had a feeling that doctors were not being told the full story about the effectiveness of these drugs in children or their side effects. So when she got a job with the New York Attorney General's office, she decided to look into this issue. And what she discovered was that GlaxoSmithKline had deliberately hid negative findings about its antidepressant, Paxil, in the treatment of depression in children and adolescents. And she found a lot of other things as well, and she eventually persuaded her colleagues, and as you'll see from reading the book, it took some doing, to sue GlaxoSmithKline for allegedly deceiving physicians and consumers about Paxil. And so I subsequently, after realizing what an interesting story this was, I was fascinated by these women and their determination to fight for the public good, kind of the David Goliath story. And I was also intrigued by another Harvard Medical School professor, Martin Teicher, who first raised questions about the safety of Prozac, which was the first antidepressant, what's so-called SSRI antidepressant, to win FDA approval, and it was quickly followed by Zoloft and Paxil. So I kind of wanted to understand what compelled Marty and Donna to risk their careers and speak out against the pharmaceutical industry. And I was also interested in Rose Firestein's story. So when I started delving into this case and how it came about, I realized it would be a dramatic story, and I subsequently discovered that Martin Keller and other researchers at Brown had actually skewed scientific data to make Paxil look more effective than it really was in treating children. For instance, as you talked about, they actually miscoded some of the teenagers in the study, saying that they were non-compliant with medication, when in fact they were having side effects, adverse effects from taking Paxil that was making them suicidal and very combative. But by miscoding them as being non-compliant, they were able not to include them in the group of teenagers who were suicidal as a result of taking placebo, and that was the way they made Paxil look safer than it really was. And in fact, you know, years later, the FDA, who started looking into this study after the New York Attorney General's office sued GlaxoSmithKline, they began investigating and really looking at the raw data and realized that this study that purported to show, the study by Martin Keller that purported to show that Paxil was safe and effective in treating children, actually did not show that there was any significant effectiveness or efficacy over placebo, and that the side effects were far worse than they had acknowledged in the their published study.
What eventually happened to Martin Keller, and did anything happen to GlaxoSmithKline?
Well, that's a good question, Dr. Bragan. A year after my a year after my book came out, Marty Keller stepped down as chief of psychiatry at Brown, although he is still a professor there and still has funding to do medical research from the National Institutes of Health. This is happening even as there's been this groundswell of pressure on Brown and also on the journal that published this initial and very erroneous Paxil study to retract the study because the data do not support the conclusions of the study.
So the journal has refused to retract?
Excuse me?
The journal has refused to retract?
So far, they are not they have
declined.
It's the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry.
And they're a bad bunch.
That's right. When I did my research, it turns out that they had submitted the journal article, which, by the way, was ghostwritten by a medical contractor hired by GlaxoSmithKline, and it's part of, you know, this ghostwriting happens much too often in the medical publishing field. But the medical contractor tried to get the article published in the New England Journal of Medicine first. Of course, they always go try the most prestigious journals first. And reviewers flagged the data and said, no, you know, there's some real problems with it. And interestingly enough, I got hold of some of the confidential peer review notes, comments that were made, even when the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry sent it out for peer review. The peer reviewers flagged some of the same problems, but they published the journal article anyway. And as I point out in my book, that may be because some of the authors of the published article were on the board, like Graham Emsley was on the board of this journal. So there was political connections at work here, and they went ahead and published the study anyway. But there's been, like I said, some real pressure to retract it.
Graham Emsley is a piece of work himself.
Right. He did a lot of the original studies on Prozac, and which have also been called into question. And he was on the board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he is responsible for Prozac, you know, having gotten some approval for kids.
That's right.
And it's interesting. I followed that study from way back. Before the Graham Emsley study of Prozac in children was published, he gave a talk that happened to get covered in one of the psychiatric newspapers, in which he said they were finding an increased rate of anger and a significant percentage of the children were becoming manic.
Mm-hmm.
So when the study came out, I just jumped on it to read because I thought, wow, this is going to be great. It's going to show that the kids had a lot of anger and a lot of them will be becoming manic. And I read the introduction to the study, wasn't there. I read the discussion of the study, wasn't there. I read the conclusions of the study, wasn't there. Mm. In fact, anger isn't mentioned anywhere in the study. And the only way you find out that 6% of the kids dropped out because of mania is the only way you find it out is it's a slight mention under reasons for discontinuation of the drug.
Mm-hmm.
So they do this whole study promoting Prozac for kids, which is really terrible for, and you have to be prepared like me to spend an hour or two reading this article from beginning to end to find that data. I mean,
right.
You're giving some really good illustrations of the degree to which this whole system is corrupt, something I've been writing about, obviously, since about 1990, starting with toxic psychiatry. Now, Martin Teicher was one of the first to publish an article,
as you said,
pointing out that Prozac caused
increase in suicidal ideation.
Yeah, exactly.
Among adult patients taking.
Among adults, yes, among
that's
adult
right.
patients.
And what was so fascinating about Dr. Teicher is, I mean, he was, you know, a Harvard Medical School professor, very establishment, just looking into this because he worked at McLean Hospital and treated adult patients with depression. And so he published this case study, which found a greater preponderance of suicidal ideation among these patients who had never before been suicidal and started taking Prozac. And the drug company that makes Prozac, Eli Lilly, just jumped on him and proceeded to, you know, put a lot of pressure on him not to continue writing about it and actually dragged his name through the mud, as I talk about in my book, with lawsuits.
By the way,
and
which they spent millions doing that to me, Rose,
mm-hmm.
long before Teicher.
Right. Oh, I know.
Go ahead, though. So then tell us what happened with Teicher, because as far as I know, he quit doing anything controversial.
Well, that's right, because they, you know, had this deposition of him in one of the lawsuits that families of someone who killed themselves while they were on Prozac, okay, that they had sued Eli Lilly for this, and he testified in the suit. Well, the deposition they dragged in, they basically really tried to smear his reputation, and they offered, right around the same time, they offered his ex-wife a job back at Eli Lilly doing cancer research, because she was a cancer researcher, and she took it and took their kids with them, so he lost the ability to see his kids on a regular basis.
That's
this
incredible.
Is all in my
they
book.
Bought his wife and pulled. Yeah, I didn't get a copy of your book. I would like to. I'd like to read it though.
Right. Right. But it's a fascinating story of how the drug company really made his life very difficult, and to the point where he never testified in an expert witness again, and went into a different area of research. He was so traumatized by what happened. I mean, when he was only trying to conduct scientific research.
I'm not so sympathetic as I think you are toward him. First of all, he did completely cop out. Others of us have not. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, he later went on to try to market, you know, another cogener of Prozac, you know,
that's right.
The mirror image of Prozac instead of having a mixture.
He was, his contention was, and this was a different, you know, that it did not have the same suicidal ideation as the other one, as Prozac. It was a somewhat different molecular formation, and, you know, it would be a safer type, and he sold it to Eli Lilly, and they eventually discarded it, I think because they didn't want the competition to Prozac. And they didn't want to acknowledge that Prozac had these suicidal tendencies.
But I can't respect that. I can't respect that he then hops right back on the pharmaceutical bandwagon, ends up selling back to Lilly, basically the same drug. You know, Prozac, chemicals usually have mirror images.
And that's
Prozac
exactly right.
Had these two mirror images, and he just pulled out one of the mirror images and said, that one's going to be better than the other one.
Right.
Same chemical compound. And so I'm not quite as kind of him in my mind.
Okay, I understand. You know, since he did that, in other words, he then left the field, he has been studying the long-term effects of child abuse on the brain. And so that's a very fruitful and interesting, and made some interesting discoveries. And that's what he's been focusing on ever since
I hope he separates the effects of child abuse from the drugs that are given to the kids who are then depressed and anxious.
Right, right, right.
One of the things my wife and I are seeing a great deal of now is that researchers are publishing articles confirming atrophy of the brain caused by a whole variety of psychiatric drugs, including, of course, the antipsychotics, but also claiming and saying that it's the psychosis rather than the drugs, which is positively unscientific, bizarre, and unfounded. So we're seeing a lot of this trying to show that psychiatric problems are biologic, which further justifies biological psychiatry. So the more I learn about Teicher even today, the more suspect I am that he's just out there pushing the biological psychiatry model, which is so destructive to people. But I'm very interested. If I just go on and Google him, am I going to find some of his work on child abuse?
Yeah,
and
he
brain
isn't. Injury? He's really not talking about a biological model. What he's trying to show is that the environment, okay, the effects of the environment, neglect and abuse, actually can alter behavior and change, circuits, neurocircuits in the brain. So it's not, you know, so this, it actually contradicts this idea that you were born a certain way, the biological model. It's saying that there's a very subtle but very real interplay between nature and nurture, and that nurture can affect nature as much as nature can affect nurture. So I think he's made some interesting contributions to the field.
Yeah, I have no doubt that we do have brains. I've seen images of them, so I know we have brains, and I know that those brains are, the cause of our behavior, they're required for our behavior and our thinking and our thoughts, and that they will change and grow depending on how much we play racquetball, how much we think, how much we go through war, whether we've been through trauma, that our brains, of course, are these plastic organs that are reflecting our growth and development. So naturally, it's common sense that as we get more refined in our looking at the brains, we'll be able to perhaps someday be able to say, yeah, this person does a lot of math, or this person does a lot of this or that, because the brain gets involved and the brain is going to change according to our experiences and according to our own self-generated activities. But of course, that, as you were pointing out, that does not mean that these are disorders. It's no more a disorder if your brain changes from abuse, unless you've been hit in the head and you have brain injury, than if it changes from you're spending all your time doing visual activities rather than verbal or musical ones. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is all very interesting. What about Rose Firestein? Is she still active? Is she still, where
yes.
is she, do you know?
Well, she's an amazing woman. What I didn't mention is that even at a time when she was a newcomer to Attorney General's office, she is legally blind, and yet she does all her depositions from memory, and she's an incredibly bright, resourceful attorney. And after Elliot Spitzer was the Attorney General at the time, and he encouraged her to look, to pursue her research into the pharmaceutical industry, and was very supportive in filing this lawsuit against GlaxoSmithKline. And they, by the way, there were two important ramifications of the lawsuit. They settled it for several million dollars, which, of course, in today's world is not very much.
That wasn't even a slap on the wrist. That was a hug.
Right. But what they did, more importantly, a condition of the settlement was that they had to publish the results of all their clinical trial data on a website. Up till then, all the researchers, you didn't have to publish negative findings. So in this case, there were a number of other trials, clinical trials in children involving Paxil, which actually found nothing or negative results, and they just hid them. In other words, they didn't publish them. And so it gives doctors a skewed idea that when they only publish the purported positive finding, which, as we found out later, the Paxil study that I wrote about wasn't really very positive. But the point is that because of the settlement from this lawsuit, they required GlaxoSmithKline to publish all of the results of their clinical trials on a publicly available website, and that led to the controversy over Avandia, which is an anti-diabetes drug made by GlaxoSmithKline. What happened was, because all the raw data from the studies of Avandia had to be published on the website, Steve Nissen from the Cleveland Clinic saw that the raw data showed that there was an increased risk of heart failure in people taking Avandia. He did a big meta-analysis, and basically Avandia has since been pulled from the market. So because of the New York Attorney General's lawsuit that required GlaxoSmithKline to publish the results of all of their clinical trials, not just the positive ones, there's been this major advance forward. And as a result, Congress, after that settlement, actually passed a law requiring all pharmaceutical companies to publish the results of all their clinical trials, not just the positive ones. So that's been a major step forward. The problem with that is that they still don't have to publish the results in journals, and it's very hard for both doctors and consumers to go onto a website and figure out what the raw data means. Somebody has to translate it and interpret it for the public, and journals still have a tendency to publish positive findings rather than negative findings, and that remains a problem in the field. So
yeah,
anyway, getting back to Rose, yeah.
Where is she now?
After Elliot Spitzer left and became governor, she was recruited to the state. She works in the Department of Health and Human Services for the state, and she's still, involved in suing and holding the pharmaceuticals industry feet to the fire. And she's still there, even though, of course, Spitzer is not. So she still works in Manhattan, but for the state of New York.
Well, I'd love to get in touch with you. Perhaps off the radio show, you could send me a phone number for her. I'd love
to
talk with her.
Mm-hmm.
No, that'd be
amazing.
Great. We should be going to break in a minute. This is very informative. I'm learning a bit. I didn't know that that now that all the drug missed that all the drug companies have to put up their data now. I had actually missed that. So that's a real contribution, and it's just important for us to be keeping up with folks like yourself who are really aware of stuff. And after we go to the break, think about what you would like to talk about more in this arena, what we haven't covered that you think would be of interest to our audience. And let's go to music break.
Listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry, and my guest is one of the consciences of psychiatry. See, there's more than one. I haven't mentioned that before on the air. And she is Allison Bass, the author of Side Effects, who has looked into, in particular, the area of Paxil and GlaxoSmithKline, but she's done a lot of other work in the field of medical investigation. Allison, one of the things that's was very striking to me in the beginning when I first started researching drug company shenanigans, and first it was mostly around Prozac, and then when I looked into Paxil and GlaxoSmithKline, I found the same kinds of fraud and deception. And it was hard for me. It was shocking. It was difficult for me to come to grips with the behavior of these companies, really, I guess, with human behavior. And I myself, am, I believe in a free market. I believe that we need to have a free market that generates creativity and new medicines and new medical devices and so on. But golly, it's a struggle to balance that against how these companies behave. And just want to maybe have a little bit more thoughtful discussion on that issue than perhaps I've had on the air before. And I wonder about your thoughts.
Well, I think that it's not just the companies. They're acting in concert with the medical establishment. What's at stake here really is the very credibility of scientific medicine, because the companies could not publish these research results, and they could not market their drugs illegally and mislead the American public without academic researchers who are willing to sign on and help them. And what happens is that they pay these researchers very handsomely. Not only do they pay a large sum to actually do the research, so in research funding, which more and more universities are dependent on funding from the private sector for research, particularly as the federal funding faces cutbacks, the NIH and NSF face cutbacks in their funding. So universities are more and more dependent for getting this research funding. But in addition, the very researchers who are being funded to do these studies on Paxil and Prozac and Zoloft and the antipsychotics and many other drugs are also being paid on the side in huge consulting and speaking fees from the same drug companies. And many of them fail to disclose these conflicts of interest. And many times the universities look the other way when they have these conflicts of interest. So that's also been part of what I've been writing about both in my book and on my regular blog. I have a weekly blog that I write that you can find through my website, allison-bass.com, online. And the problem with, is that these academic medicine has colluded in many respects because they need the money and because there are researchers who have undisclosed conflicts of interest. And, you know, there are some very famous examples of Joseph Biederman at Mass General, who had undisclosed conflicts of interest. He was getting lots of money from Johnson & Johnson to promote Risperdal, its antipsychotic. And yet he was the leading proponent of the idea that of expanding the criteria for manic depression in young children so that they then needed these very potent psychoactive antipsychotics like Risperdal and Zyprexa and Seroquel. And he was failing to let his patients and the public know that he was getting all this money on the side from Johnson & Johnson.
That's an
undisclosed conflict of interest, yes.
I went head-to-head against Biederman at the Consensus Development Conference on ADHD and its diagnosis and treatment back in the, I guess it's the 1980s now, and I was a scientific expert on the adverse effects of psychiatric drugs in children at the ADHD conference. And he was a very nasty and hostile person, and afterward I looked some more into what he was saying, and I blew the whistle way back then on the fact that he wasn't announcing all of the monies he was getting. I had no idea how much they were, but I would track him, and he would list one thing one place, one thing another place. And I noticed very early that that was going on. And then, of course, as you're saying, he then went ahead and he took money, literally, in order to push bipolar disorder as a diagnosis in children, in collaboration with the manufacturers of Risperdal and probably other drugs in order to be drugging more of our kids. And that's Harvard. That's Harvard. You know,
that's
in psychiatry, my experience, Allison, is the best is the worst in psychiatry. When I got to Harvard and had my first year of residency in psychiatry at Harvard, I realized that the best was the worst because Harvard was, this was 1962-63, Allison, I'm that old, and Harvard made a one-year total changeover from being a psychologically, socially oriented psychiatry department to being a completely drug and hopefully computer. That never happened, but a drug and computer oriented. It was a political decision, wasn't scientific. It was back in the early 60s. And so the best is the worst because the best in psychiatry is most closely connected to the drug companies. And you're certainly right. This is well beyond the drug companies. It's the whole medical profession, but the money that drives it comes from the drug companies. Do you have thoughts about what can be done about this? I mean, I struggle with this.
I think one of the proposed solutions, and this is something that Marcia Angel talks about in her book, The Truth About Drug Companies, is that I think the control of clinical trials should be taken out of the hands of drug companies. Right now, the drug companies do these randomized clinical trials, and then the results are then used to get approval with the FDA for the drugs and for new types of using them in new conditions. And it also allows them to use, once drugs are approved and on the market, doctors can prescribe them for off-label uses as well. So I think that, and a lot of the times these clinical trials are skewed, as I pointed out in my book, and they're not accurate, and there is even evidence of scientific misconduct in a number of different drug trials, and it's not just drugs for psychiatry. Vioxx, which was a painkiller, which had a elevated rate of heart failure, and they hid that. Merck hid that side effect, Avandia, as I've already talked about, and many other drugs where the clinical trials don't accurately reflect what's really going on with the effectiveness and safety of these drugs. So I think that there should be an independent agency monitored by the federal government which does clinical trials with money donated by the drug companies, but they should not have control over the data itself and over how it's published and how it's written up. I think that would take care of a lot of the ghostwriting that goes on, and a lot of the scientific misconduct and misleading of the American public if these clinical trials were administered by independent researchers working for a federal agency. So that's
well, I can see to some extent how that might be helpful, but you know, my wife and I have spent a lot of time looking at the government, looking at the FDA. I've written a lot about it, looking at NIH, and they're not much better, and maybe not better than the drug companies, because they're all ultimately a part of the psychopharmaceutical complex. When I first started criticizing Prozac publicly, the first rebuttal to be published on the New York Times on their op-ed page was by the head of research at NIMH, But what he didn't say was that he was going to be a vice president at Eli Lilly, whom he was defending on the New York Times without saying so. And the FDA often seems to be in collusion with the drug companies. I mean, to hold secret meetings with Eli Lilly at the FDA in order to figure out how to handle the mounting criticism of Prozac.
Well, I think that for many years, I think during the 90s, I call them the go-go 90s, up until really the recent, the Obama administration, I think the FDA there's been a revolving door between, as you say, between researchers for the FDA. Doctors who worked at the FDA and the drug industry. Also, there's because Congress doesn't fully fund the FDA to be an independent federal agency and do its own work, the FDA has become increasingly reliant on drug user fees, which come from the pharmaceutical industry, and that is now well over more than 50% of their entire drug review budget comes from pharmaceutical drug user fees. So consumer advocates, that's a real problem. They say that the FDA is beholden to the very industry that it's supposed to regulate. The problem is that Congress won't fund the FDA, won't give the kind of funding the FDA needs to be a truly independent agency. And similarly, there are problems at the NIH as well, that in terms of very close collaboration with the industry and with researchers who are on the industry's payroll. I mean, I think that there have been some reforms, particularly since 2008. I think that, for instance, the NIH has stiffened its regulations on conflict of interest. In other words, making it, increasing the penalties for researchers that don't disclose conflicts of interest and financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry. But even then, the NIH recently, they just did this summer, and they dropped a very important provision in the new regulations that would have led to increased transparency, and that would be that every university should post these conflicts of interest on their website so that individuals and journalists can find what the individual conflicts of interest are right then and there online, instead of having to go through a press office or do a Freedom of Information Act request, which makes it very hard. But the universities, sadly enough, the universities were the ones that pressured the NIH to drop that provision because they didn't want that kind of transparency, and that's very sad. Because, as I said before, it's because they're increasingly beholden on private sector funding.
So. Yeah. I really agree with you. You're drawing the picture of what I've written about and called the psychopharmaceutical complex. And it involves the drug companies as the fountain of money. It involves the government agencies. It involves the psychiatric and medical associations. It involves the medical schools and universities and the journals. And the researchers, and also the insurance companies, because they have the idea that they're saving money by drugging people rather than paying for therapy, because they're not factoring in all the hospitalizations for adverse drug effects that they're getting when they push the medications. It's a huge problem. I appreciate the suggestions you're making. I'm a bit skeptical. I've never seen the government do a better job than somebody else, or at least hardly ever. And the stuff I saw with Prozac, which was perhaps the leading abomination I ever really got into in my life of studying and being attacked by, that was before the drug companies were participating in funding the FDA. The ties are so close. You know, Paul Lieber for decades was the head of the psychiatric part of the FDA. And, of course, the minute Lieber left the FDA, he set up as an independent consultant to, guess whom, the drug companies. So it's really a tough problem, and I appreciate the suggestions you're making. I don't have better ones.
I do think that, you know, our federal regulators do need to be allowed to do their jobs and to get more funding to be independent. The problem is with the current Congress, they've been introducing a lot of legislation which actually would hobble the FDA even further, particularly with medical devices, not just drugs. So the American people have to be aware that, all of the special interest money that makes it very difficult, the special interest money coming from the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry and the medical device industry, which makes it very difficult for federal agencies to operate independently of this industrial complex you're talking about. And it is a problem, but I think that all you can do is increase public awareness and make people aware of the connections so that they do hold their congressional representatives to account. And what really needs to be done, Peter, is to reform the system of campaign financing so that Congress is not reliant on all this special interest money, and that and their campaigns are paid for out of a public pocket, so that they are not in the tank to the pharmaceutical and healthcare industries, and so that they can allow federal regulators to do the kinds of independent work they need to do to protect the American public.
Well, I wish I had the faith in government that you do. I think we come from different directions on that, but it's a very important conversation we're having. One of the issues that I think would be very important would be the whole idea of proprietary knowledge. Because right now it's marvelous that the clinical trials are being put up on the web, but what isn't going to be put up on the Internet is the kinds of instructions that go to the investigators that, in effect, tell the investigators what adverse effects they can even check off. You know, they get check-off lists, and if they don't put in akathisia, you're not going to find out that the drugs are causing akathisia. I found out that Paxil was causing akathisia by looking at associated reports of things like jumpiness, nervousness, agitation, and things like that. And I was able to draw a picture out of that, that there was a lot of akathisia being created but never named. So how far do you think we could get with the Congress? Now, how far should we ethically go in saying that these drug companies have to be open, their doors to everything?
There have been some reforms in that area as well. As a result of the New York Attorney General's lawsuit against GlaxoSmithKline, a number of the leading medical journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, all the top journals got together and said that they insisted that if a researcher wants to be published in their journal, they have to publish the initial protocol and design of the trial on a publicly available website like clinicaltrials.gov, the NIH website, so that all those instructions are there up on a publicly available website, so that they cannot change the protocol halfway through to again make the drug look better than it really is. I mean, that happened with the Paxil study. When they found out that the primary outcome measures did not show that Paxil was more effective than placebo in treating depression in children, the researchers at Brown and the other sites just changed the protocol and changed the outcome measures. To basic better fit. In other words, they brought up some secondary measures that looked like they were that made it look like it was effective, and they didn't use the primary outcome measures, which is patently unethical. You cannot change a study midstream like that.
Allison, where do people get the protocols on the website. It's
called clinicaltrials.gov. It's clinical. If you type in clinicaltrials.gov, I think that's the name of the website. And so, in other words, so that these protocols have to be published if the researchers eventually want to be published in these leading medical journals. However, there was a recent study that was done by Harlan Krumholtz at Yale that showed there's still not a lot of compliance with this mandate by the journals. In other words, there's still a lot of clinical trials that are not being, the protocols are not being published, and they're still being changed. It's better than it was, but it's not nearly as good as it needs to be. And so far that's not, I mean, the FDA is not regulating this, which it should. It's up to the, you know, the journals are the ones who are saying, look, you've got to publish these protocols ahead so we know if you've made changes. But then it becomes incumbent on the editors of these journals to check the protocols to make sure that things haven't changed once the manuscript is submitted for publication. And that, you know, that's extra work, and a lot of them don't do it. So,
And also it's their buddies who are sending in the articles.
Well, there are problems with the peer review system, and we could talk about that. There's no question. I mean, the peer review is better than no peer review, but it certainly is flawed. I absolutely agree with you on that score.
And I'm not even sure that peer review is better than no peer review, because the main function that I see in my work as a critic of what's going on in science, so-called science of psychiatry, is that peer review is largely used to make sure that the old boys club that doesn't criticize basic criticism doesn't enter into the main journals, because you're criticizing the very people who are on the peer review system. So I think peer review is actually a very double-edged sword in which, yes, on the one hand, maybe it helps the quality of the science, but on the other hand, it makes absolutely certain that nothing fundamentally critical in medicine and psychiatry is going to get into the major journals. Do you disagree with that?
I think that peer review is better than no system at all. I've seen examples where the peer reviewers have done their jobs and flagged studies that were very flawed, and as a result, those studies weren't published, despite the fact that they were powerful. Their authors were powerful. So I do think peer review does its job.
But does it do more harm than
good?
I'm not so sure. I wish it would, but I'm not sure. So sure. We're getting near to the end of our time together. Not quite there yet. First, I want to say to the listeners and to Allison that this is one of the most informative shows I've done, and indeed one of the most informative hours that I've had with a, if I can call you a colleague. I'm not a journalist, but with someone working in this field of taking a good hard look at what is the science of medicine and psychiatry about. It's been incredibly informative, Allison Best. Now, and again, your book is Side Effects. Allison, you're obviously staying up on a lot of these issues. What are you doing? What's your next book? Is most of what you're doing coming out in your blog? How do you earn a living?
Well, thank you for your compliments and for asking. I actually teach journalism at two universities, and that's how I pay my bills. I teach at Brandeis University and Mount Holyoke College. So I teach health and science journalism at both of those universities, along with digital and multimedia journalism. And I also, like I said, write a regular blog, and I am working on my next nonfiction book, which I've been told I can't talk about it yet because I don't have a book contract, but I am working with an agent to get a book contract on my next nonfiction book, which will also be investigative and in the public health field. And as soon as I get a contract, I'll let the world know.
Well, that's great. And the next time you feel it would be in your interest, I'd be happy to have you back on the show talking about the latest work that you're doing. You have any summary comments you'd like to make before I sum up and wish I had cleared everybody?
Well, I just hope that anybody who's listening will understand that the political system, they need to get involved in the political system, and they need to vote in people in Congress and the presidency who are interested in campaign finance reform and who understand the connections between special interest money and the corruption in our system of medical research and drug development. And so the more people understand that, the more they will hold their elected representatives accountable. And that's why it's so important to be involved in the political system.
I agree. And just to balance some of that view, my own experience is that the biggest and worst interest group is the government itself. So we have a little bit different view on that.
Yes,
I think that the power of government is actually the source of the worst oppression on the face of the earth. So I'm not so sanguine about that. One thing that I think we haven't talked about at all, and we're really near at the end here, I think so important is the ability to sue the drug companies. And a lot of people who hold some of my views on politics don't agree with this part at all, which is I think we don't need tort reform to weaken the capacity of people to sue these companies. We need tort reform to make it more possible to sue these companies, because so much of the truth that comes out through the suits, and my books are just filled with information, toxic psychiatry and now brain-disabling treatments in psychiatry and medication madness are filled with data I've gotten from the drug companies against their wishes in product liability suits. You're a wonderful guest, Alison Bass, the author of Side Effects. Read her book, read her blog. I'm just delighted to have had you on my show,
and
thank you very much.
And thank you for having me as well.
And Happy New Year to everyone out there. Stay in touch Mondays at 5 with this show. There's no place else where you're going to hear so much interesting information about science and psychiatry and about how to really look at these issues in an honest, honorable, and ethical way. And I thank Alison Bass for contributing to that. Bye now.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.